impact diplomatic ties with Lebanon's government and further destabilize the country. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, along with UNRWA and the Palestinian Ministry of Public Works, held a workshop in the Gaza Strip to discuss Israel's latest destruction of hundreds of buildings during the May War. According to the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, over 100,000 internally displaced persons, or IDPs, sought shelter and protection at UNRWA schools or with hosting families. Currently, there are still about 8,000 Palestinian IDPs, primarily those whose houses were completely destroyed or severely damaged during the one-ton Israeli bombardment.
The Israeli war in May caused massive destruction, especially to residential areas, and thousands of families have been internally displaced. The delay of reconstruction is a direct result of the Israeli blockade. Israel bans the entry of building supplies into the Gaza Strip in a direct and grave violation of the international law and the Fourth Geneva Convention.
People and businesses in the Gaza Strip are still waiting for the reconstruction to start. In addition to bombing thousands of buildings and infrastructure, Israeli regime forces also killed hundreds of innocent civilians, including women and children.
It was 7 p.m. on the last day of the holy month of Ramadan when the apartment building where I lived was bombed. Israeli warplanes first fired a drone rocket and minutes later hit the building with an F-16 bomb. My family is currently displaced and we are just lucky to be still alive. We call on all the world to help us rebuild our homes.
Over 2,200 Palestinians were also injured during the Israeli air raids, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability requiring rehabilitation. Hundreds of Palestinian families have lost everything during Israel's May onslaught, and their plight has no end in sight.
My house was bombed on the morning of Eid al-Fitr around 5 a.m. It was a horrific scene beyond description. Can you imagine being with your wife and children preparing for the holiday, and all of a sudden your house is bombed and no longer have a place to call home?
Many Gazans had their lives shattered because of the recent war, and they still have no proper place to raise their families. Rights groups accuse donor countries of failing to fulfill their financial pledges to rebuild the tiny coastal territory and end the illegal and inhumane Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Dozens more souls, including those of a pregnant woman, and several children lost to the sea. More lives lost in a dangerous quest to cross the English Channel. And even as the recovery efforts continue, the blame game intensified between the UK and France on how this tragedy unfolded and who should shoulder the blame.
I've offered to work with France to put more officers on the ground and do absolutely whatever is necessary to secure the area so that vulnerable people do not risk their lives by getting into unseaworthy boats.
The British Prime Minister was more forthright.
We've had difficulties persuading some of our partners, particularly the French, to do things in a way that we think is the situation deserves.
All these women and men do not want asylum in France. We offer them all. Those who want it are taken care of in the centres made available in Calais and Dunkirk, and we will strengthen the means of rescue at sea. But above all, we need to develop much stronger and more responsible partners.
This is yet another unsavoury chapter for Priti Patel's Home Office. And with the issue of migration, legal or otherwise, firmly linked to the Conservatives' law and order agenda, campaigners are urging the government to depoliticize this issue, seek cross-border solutions that may well save innocent lives.
Everything about how this government has approached the question of cross-channel refugees has been political point scoring and game playing with human lives and people escaping persecution, war and abuse, and subjecting them to criminalization and demonization.
For many campaigners, the connection has to be made between the UK's foreign policy and the refugee crisis.
The truth is that the vast majority of refugees trying to get here are victims of war, and this is from a whole number of countries in which Britain has been centrally involved in these wars.
Boris Johnson has said no option is off the table.
As long as they keep treating this crisis as a crisis of invasion and criminality instead of a crisis of humanity and devastation across the world that is driving people to seek refuge, you are going to have more people die.
Tightening restrictions will mean more dangerous conditions for those hoping to get into Britain by any means necessary. This can only mean more lives lost in the days, weeks, and months to come. Amina Taylor, London.
The United States has always touted itself as a leading democracy in the world. In line with such a narrative, the U.S. is scheduled to hold a so-called summit on democracy next month. But the names of some of the participants and absentees cast doubt on the motive behind such an event. The inclusion of Taiwan, and not China, poses not only a challenge to Washington, but exposes its real intention.
The U.S. action to push forward the group politics and provoke allied confrontations under the cover of democracy is a reproduction of the Cold War mentality, which is widely questioned and opposed by the wise persons in the international community.
Russia, which has also been excluded from the summit, said the meeting is aimed at creating divisions among countries and privatizing the term democracy.
They wish to privatize the very word democracy. In their opinion, democracy is only what corresponds to Washington's understanding of democracy. Obviously, this cannot be so and must not be so. And in fact, it is not.
Another challenge the U.S. faces is its decision to include Israel in the list of over 100 invitees to the virtual gathering. It has put a big question mark to the democratic nature of the event, given the Israeli regime's atrocities and crimes against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip on a daily basis. The administration of President Joe Biden claims the summit seeks to help stop democratic backsliding and erosion of rights and freedoms worldwide. Nonetheless, earlier this week, the Stockholm-based International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance said it is the first time that the U.S. has been added to its list titled Backsliding Democracies. The international think tank also pointed to a, quote, decline in the quality of freedom of association and assembly in the U.S. during the summer 2020 protests after the police killing of George Floyd. Floyd's death once again turned the spotlight on racial bias toward African Americans and other minority groups in the U.S. The support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen and huge arms sales to the kingdom also put a question mark on U.S. claims to be a leading human rights advocate. The U.S. military adventurism has also exposed its real face. Invasions of Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and some other countries under different pretexts, including fighting terrorism and bringing democracy, have only resulted in the loss of lives of hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians. Sanctions are yet another tool the United States has used for decades against others, including Iran and Venezuela. But the economic warfare has brought suffering to the people in these countries, as they are unable to access the basic humanitarian needs such as food and medicines, leading to the death of many innocent people. Given the humanitarian impacts of U.S. policies and its long-standing support for undemocratic regimes, it remains to be seen how Washington wants to protect democracy in the format of its planned summit.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors convenes a virtual meeting a day after IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi's trip to Tehran. Addressing the board, Grossi said the extensive negotiations with high-ranking Iranian officials to address outstanding issues had proven inconclusive, but that he would not give up on efforts to come to an understanding.
The talks were constructive, the talks were correct, the talks were professional, so that is one thing, but we could not reach an agreement.
Grossi said the sides must reach an agreement that would allow the agency to access surveillance equipment at Iran's Karaj workshop, warning the IAEA is close to the point where it would not be able to guarantee the continuity of knowledge. Iran says it's conducting a judicial and security investigation at the site following a terrorist attack blamed on Israel and cannot legally allow the agency access while the investigation is underway. Tehran has asked the IAEA to assist in the investigation, as the attack destroyed one of the agency's cameras. In a separate report to the board, Rossi also mentioned questions that still need to be clarified about the presence of uranium particles at three locations not declared to the agency. Iran has previously responded by asking the IAEA not to magnify non-urgent issues related to the country's past activities, saying some of the questions are based on unsubstantiated claims and images provided by the country's enemies. Iranian officials say, despite differences of opinion with the agency, efforts will continue to bring the outstanding issues to a final resolution. Iran has also urged other IAEA member states to refrain from adopting any hasty or politically motivated position. Homalezgi, Vienna.
It's envisaged EU leaders and the European Parliament will almost certainly rubber stamp new anti-immigrant proposals put forward by the European Commission on Tuesday. Any airline or ferry company deemed by the EU to be carrying illegal immigrants destined for the bloc will be placed on a blacklist. The Commission accuses Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko of bringing migrants to EU borders in retaliation for sanctions imposed on Minsk.
I think he has missed the game, because what he has got is a new round of sanctions, and now he will have to contribute and to take care of these people.
The European Commission is giving €200 million to EU countries Poland, Lithuania and Latvia for border controls. Poland is already accused of human rights abuses against migrants. Between 10 and 15,000 migrants are still in Belarus. The EU is spending a total of €3.5 million to facilitate their deportation.
We are now ready to accelerate with many more planes coming out of Belarus, and we will mobilize additional funds of around €1 million to support these returns.
It has never been harder for genuine refugees to reach the European Union. Under international law, they are entitled to seek asylum here. Most of them are in countries ravaged by Western war machines.
Vulnerable asylum seekers and refugees are getting caught in the middle and falling through the gaps. So we need the kind of political will that member states express when they come together and meet, but don't then follow through.
EU leaders will hold a summit here at the European Council in just under a month's time from now, and the refugee crisis will be high on the agenda. Rights groups are pleading with them to switch the focus from border protection to people protection. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi,
sir. Hi, kiddie. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terence fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sin.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, in a move to apparently increase the pressure on the Islamic resistance even further, Recently, we have seen the Palestinian group Hamas's political wing labeled by the UK government as a terrorist group. And the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah's political faction has also been labeled as a terrorist group by Australia. As both of these organizations defend their people against terrorists, the question to be asked perhaps is, what is terrorism and who is considered a terrorist by these countries which say they stand against terrorism, but apparently the reality is something else. What does it all mean? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on Spotlight.
A plot to silence anti-Israel resistance groups. This is what many describe the latest move by Australia and the UK to blacklist Lebanese and Palestinian resistance movements. Canberra announced this decision on Wednesday.
Today I'm announcing my intention to list the base and the entirety of Hezbollah as terrorist organisations under the Criminal Code. Now, listing these organisations sends a very strong message that Australia condemns the use of terrorism to achieve political, ideological or religious objectives.
In 2003, Australia blacklisted Hezbollah's military wing, but Wednesday's decision expanded the list to include the group's political wing, which is a powerful player in Lebanon's politics, with seats in parliament and cabinet. On November 19, the British government did the same with the political wing of Hamas, joining the United States, Canada and the European Union in fully banning the group.
And today, I have laid an order in the United Kingdom Parliament to amend Schedule 2 of the Terrorism Act 2000 to proscribe Hamas in its entirety, including its political wing.
The decisions have been slammed by resistance groups, with Hamas calling Britain's move unlawful.
The decision is a crime against the Palestinian people and against its historical struggle. This is a condemnation of our right to defend ourselves. It is a political and ethical mistake and unlawful by Britain, added to its first crime, when they had the Balfour Declaration. This step is to satisfy the occupation.
Hezbollah has also denounced Australia's move. Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah says the decision to blacklist the group will not affect its resolve and determination.
Putting the name of Hezbollah into the list of terrorist organizations may be due to regional developments or parliamentary election. However, such designations will not affect the determination of the resistance, nor the support for it.
Both Hezbollah and Hamas have been fighting against the Israeli regime's occupation of their lands for decades. Hezbollah was established following the 1982 Israeli invasion and occupation of southern Lebanon. The movement drove out Israeli forces from Lebanon in May 2000, though Tel Aviv still occupies parts of Lebanon. Hamas also plays a significant role in defending Palestinian rights against frequent Israeli aggressions. The U.S. has already blacklisted both groups to appease the Israeli regime, which was created and nourished by Washington and its Western allies. Australia, the U.S. and Britain are now in a trilateral security pact and are not the only main suppliers of weapons to Israel, but regularly vote against anti-Israeli resolutions at the UN. Their latest moves have exposed their intentions even further, as they have chosen to support the aggressors at the expense of the victims.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier out of Edinburgh. And historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off with Mick. Mick, your overall perspective, because as was said in the opening and also in the package, I mean, Canada and the U.S. and the EU had for years now actually is said that both these organizations were terrorist organizations. It's interesting. Why do you think the UK and Australia had not done that before, and why have they done it now, in your perspective?
I mean, I can't comment on the precise timing of this. I can only take the long view and say that you asked earlier, what does terrorism mean? In the lexicon of Western governments, it simply means any movement which is opposed to their view of their own interests. Could I remind your viewers, by the way, that the only government in the world which has been found guilty by the International Court of Justice of terrorism was the USA, which way back in 86 was found guilty of supporting a terrorist movement, of illegally blockading the harbours of a sovereign country, Nicaragua, and financing the murder of health workers and education workers and so on by the Contras. If you look dispassionately, let's try that, at the deployment of violence by these governments, we find that they support terrorist organizations. If by terrorism we mean the use of violence to achieve a political goal, which of course every government in the world does, it's just the way the world is. But Britain and America and Australia and Canada, I also have a Canadian passport, have been guilty of the mass extermination of native people simply in order to seize their resources. So why shouldn't they support Israel? Look, Hezbollah fought Israel in 2006. Hezbollah overwhelmingly killed Israeli soldiers. Israel overwhelmingly killed Lebanese civilians. The arithmetic is extremely stark, but one group, of course, in official parlance is called terrorist. Hamas fight to resist the Israeli plan to take over the entirety of Palestine and to expel every single Palestinian they possibly can. They fight in a way which is in line with international law, which allows for people to resist colonization, yet in the official parlance, they are the terrorists. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever to any honest observer, but we can only say that Britain and America and Australia and Canada, they take any regime, even one which dissolves its dissidents in acid, even one which carpet bombs civilians and openly talks about the destruction of civilian infrastructure in order to inflict pain on the population. These groups are never called terrorists, but any group, however benign. And we have to remember, six Palestinian NGOs have recently been designated as terrorists simply because they exist. That's the crime in the eyes of Australia and the USA. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Stay with me, Mick. Sorry about that. Let me get Brett in on this conversation. But in the last few years, we've seen increased pressure on all parts of the resistance, whether we're talking about Iran or Syria, Hezbollah, Yemen, or resistance groups in Iraq and elsewhere. All of these groups have been the recipient of much political and economic pressure. Why is that the case, and is it indicative perhaps of the success of the resistance?
Yeah, they always say that. It's a well-known saying that a cornered wild beast is sometimes the most dangerous. And I think this is exactly what is happening. We see now over the past few decades, especially ever since the conflict in Syria started, but basically we have seen now for decades a gradual pushback happening across West Asia, across the Islamic world and beyond, in which the imperialist powers are slowly but gradually being pushed back. This is definitely this definitely came to the forefront following the 1979 Iranian revolution and the inspiration that it has offered to a lot of people across the Muslim world and across sectarian divides, Shia or Sunni alike. And we have seen a sort of resurgence in the late 20th century, and of course in the first two decades of this century, a resurgence of domestic resistance against imperialism and against Zionism. And this is something that has rendered, I believe, which has caused a massive fear among the Zionist entity and amongst their backers and supporters in the West and across the world. And that is the reason why they have been really stepping up their pressure even more. They have been stepping up diplomatic pressure, they have been stepping up military campaigns, and they have been stepping up pressure and bribery across the Islamic world, which we have seen with the so-called Abraham Accords last year, in which countries such as Morocco and Bahrain have decided to officially collaborate with the Zionist entity, something that in many cases they were already doing secretly before, but now made it completely official and on the forefront. And I think the reason for that is that Israel, as has been testified by a former leader of the Internal Security Service of Israel, the Shin Bet, who spoke to a Zionist newspaper a couple of years ago, I believe, this former Shin Bet director said that, demographically speaking, when things keep on going like they are right now, Israel will have most likely no future in, let's say, the coming in 30 years or so from now, you're speaking of, in about a generation, simply because of the fact that they are basically running out slowly. They're running out of numeric advantage. They're running out of colonists. They're running out of the population growth of Jewish colonists in Israel in order to take over, numerically speaking, the Palestinian people still living there. So what they feel the need to do is they want to ensure that their vision, their view, that Zionist vision of the world, which has been so omnipresent in Western media, is pushed in the minds of people even more. And that is why they have now ensured that even the normal political wing of Hezbollah and of Hamas are considered terrorist organizations in the UK, in Australia, and of course they already were in the US. And especially when you talk about Hezbollah is a legal, legitimate political party, which is supporting in many ways the current government of Lebanon. Right. So in some ways, designating Hezbollah as a terrorist organization means you designate the entire Republic of Lebanon, basically, as a terrorist organization. That is the where we have gotten to nowadays. That is the insanity that the Zionist propaganda has led us over the past year.
Well, you just mentioned, Brett, the effect of this designation. Actually, that's what I wanted to get into. Mick, as far as the effect of these designations, to these organizations themselves, and also to the people living in these countries, in Australia, in the UK, who actually support these organizations. What does it mean exactly, restriction-wise, Mick?
No, very good point. It means increased repression, and the repression has been escalating for several years now, and as our other guest points out, it's not born of confidence. The Zionist project was launched in order to produce a state by cleaning out the local people, but it would be a state where Jews around the world, in Russia and Poland, could move and feel safe in this place. It would be a lifeboat state. I mean, it was always a con, but look what's happening now. In order for this state, with maybe 6 million Zionist Jews, 7 or 8 million non-Zionist people in Palestine as well, in order for this state to continue, the balancing act that they've carried out for the last few decades is becoming increasingly intricate. They remain surrounded by hundreds of millions of people in the Middle East who are hostile to the Zionist entity, who oppose it. And in order for it to survive, they need to build alliances with dictatorial regimes, the emirs and the sheikhs of the Gulf, the Egyptian regime, the Saudi regime, and so on. And they also need very determined support against the local populations by Canada, Britain, Australia, and so on. So this repression will make it more easy to shut down bank accounts, possibly to put a few more people in jail. But the movement to cleanse the Labour Party of pro-Palestine supporters in Britain has now been spreading for quite some time into academia and elsewhere, and that will continue. But designating an organisation as terrorist means that the state can move against people much more quickly. As a Palestine solidarity campaign, we will continue to express our solidarity with Hamas. What Hamas says inside for internal Palestinian politics is no concern of ours. I may agree or I may disagree with their social policies. Their right to resist dispossession, their right to resist a regime which sometimes talks about pushing Gaza back to the Stone Age, where a minister of defense used the word Shoah, the Hebrew word for genocide, for Holocaust, he would inflict that upon the people of Gaza. The right of Hamas to resist that is unquestioned in international law and in decent morality. So there will come a clash. Those of us who will continue to support Hamas publicly as a resistance movement will come into conflict with the British government and other people in a similar position worldwide. So this is this fight remains to be won or to be lost. At the moment, the British government and other governments are losing the fight for public opinion. I can't stress this often enough.
Well let me stop you right there. You just said they're losing the fight for public opinion.
No doubt.
But on the other hand, then we see this type of pressure. We see this type of pressure and ramifications then of such a law, because of course there's jail time now that perhaps someone like yourself in the UK, for example, supporting Hamas. What does that mean? Because obviously then there's even that external pressure now being put on those supporters to probably curtail that public support.
If I could just add one more point, because our other guest has many interesting things to say. They are losing the fight. By their resistance, the Palestinians, the Lebanese, and people around the Middle East are showing that resistance can be successful. The deep unpopularity of the Israeli government needs the protection of British, Canadian, and Australian governments. It's not that they're articulating public opinion. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Zionists, in their intra-Zionist conversations, are well aware of the crisis they face in terms of public opinion across Europe, never mind the Middle East. And this repression will continue. But my own guess is, it's doomed to lose. I think we've faced this repression now in Britain, for example, for many years. Certainly in the USA, where there's a bill has gone through Congress. I think I don't know if it's been implemented, but with $1 million fines and 10-year sentences envisaged for BDS campaigners, I think this is bound to lose.
Okay.
I don't have any crystal ball, but I think they will break their teeth on resistance, because I think Palestine, if I can make one more point, is now a British domestic political issue.
Brett, after Israel has once again, in this year, 2021, waged another bloody onslaught on the highly populated Gaza Strip, killing young and old, destroying high-rise apartment buildings in front of cameras, and basically doing whatever it wanted to live. Now, we see at the same time this type of response from these various governments. But on the other hand, like Mick said, do you think that, of course, we saw with social media and showing these towers being brought down and live on TV, that it's also had a major effect on public opinion as they have seen the actual brutality of the regime that perhaps some of them were not aware of?
I think that is definitely the case, and I think indeed the other guests definitely mentioned that very well and has worded it very well, that this increased Zionist repression is not born of confidence, but it's born of fear and uncertainty. There would be no need to curtail public opinion so much, to curtail free speech so much, if there was no problem for the Zionists to work with. And I think indeed, as you have mentioned, when these conflicts happened, like over the summer, when the bombings of the Gaza Strip happened, and these numerous war crimes, which are nothing new, of course, which have been going on for over 70 years in Palestine, ever since 1948. But the difference now is that thanks in many ways, due to social media and due to the accessibility of audiovisual media across the world nowadays, we have ways to circumvent the single viewpoint that the mainstream imperialist media has been spoon-feeding people for so many decades. We see now what is going on. We see what has happened. And of course, there will always be pundits and political commentators and politicians who are trying to justify this. But I think it really speaks to the fundamental humanity of many people. Be they don't have to be Muslim, they don't have to be Arab, but that has no bearing on it anymore nowadays. It speaks to the fundamental humanity of people when we realize that this is a colonial project, that this is Zionism is in many ways a death cult which only strives for the complete ethnic cleansing of a land in order to establish and supplant basically an entirely new population on it, much like what has happened in the establishment of the United States and Australia for for which reason, again, another reason for the United States and Australia to support this project, because for them, for these governments, this is very familiar. This is how their country came to be. But for many people now, you can see what is going on. You can see what is happening. And you see a lot of people nowadays, all over the political spectrum, even in the West itself, people who are left-wing, people who are right-wing, who are rising up now against what they see is in a fundamental perversion of international law, of international justice, and also what they see nowadays, more and more people start to wake up to the fact that the national sovereignty of their own country is in many ways being subverted by politicians who dare not speak out for fear of their career, for fear of losing their funding, for fear of committing political suicide. And this is something that a lot of people have starting to understand now, that this is a conflict that is bigger than just one strip of land in Palestine, one strip of land in West Asia. This is an international concept. This is an international struggle against a group of people who believe, in this case the Zionists, who believe that people and have the right to do whatever they want, to get whatever project done and whatever goals met that they want to, and kill anyone they want along the way and break every international norm and every international law they want while trying to get to the goal that they want to achieve. More and more people are starting to understand that this is completely unjustified. You see people rising up in the United States, even in the United Kingdom, people who are not just Muslims, but Christians, even Jews, people who are non-religious, people who are religions and backgrounds, who are starting to rise up and to say and to understand and to say and to voice their opinion that this is an unjustifiable system and that this can no longer go on this way and that Zionism needs to end in order for some amount of peace to finally have a chance in the region.
Well, Mick, I mean, in this world where the entity which continually goes against international law and kills civilians at will and in prison without trial does not have to pay a price and the ones who defend the oppressed are punished, do you think that it is showing people more and more that there is no other option except resistance? You cannot rely on the international organizations, for example, the United Nations, the Geneva Conventions. None of that really has any type of meaning, unfortunately, in this world today. Do you think more and more people are realizing that resistance is the only way, and also looking at the success of the resistance and maybe for themselves also, that this is a sample of direction that they too can go into to resist?
You know, our friend pointed to the value of social media as opposed to what we call the mainstream media. It's extremely disciplined in America and Britain and so on, what people are allowed to learn about. There's real strong and very disciplined management of the news. Despite that, large numbers of people are now outside the control by elites, which has lasted until now. Politics is extremely turbulent. I mean, a sort of pathological example of this is Trump. But it means that people who used to vote in a traditional way for a traditional party are much more the system is much more unstable than it was. People are beginning to be very angry indeed. Part of that is undoubtedly opposition to foreign wars, to aggression by our governments in the Middle East. I just point out, by the way, along as a monster, Donald Trump, when he first ran for the presidency, he was very critical of Israel. He was very critical of US aid that went to Israel. Now, he changed his tune very quickly in order to get the billionaires' money from the likes of Sheldon Adelson and so on. But when he criticized Israel, it didn't do him any harm at all when he was beginning to rise in the polls. Israel is, because of Palestinian resistance, because of Lebanese resistance, Israel is already, and it's so important to bear this in mind, a pariah state in the eyes of public opinion. That has been remarkably consistent since the EU apologized to Israel for the opinions of its own citizens vis-a-vis Israel. It's simply got better from our point of view and worse from the Israeli point of view.
All right. And unfortunately, so sorry to interrupt you, Mick, but we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me on this spotlight. Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Hanefia out of Edinburgh. Historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Halsund. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A drone strike last month in the last days of the U.S. occupation follows the same logic that 20 years ago turned 9/11 from a day of tragedy and violence into two decades of tragedy and violence, says Sam Carliner Ryder in an article titled Never Forget Victims of U.S. Drone Program. Stay tuned for more. As the mainstream press spent this past week once again ensuring that Americans never forget the fear and anger of 9/11, which prompted 20 years of war, 10 of the latest victims of 9/11 were being wiped from historical memory. Just 2 weeks before the 20th anniversary of 9/11, a U.S. drone killed the Ahmadi family, including 7 children. In the U.S.-centric writing of history, they have already been forgotten. The U.S. military surveilled 43-year-old Zemari Ahmadi throughout his final day. He went about his normal routine as a Kabul-based employee of the aid group Nutrition and Education International. Ahmadi dropped off his co-workers at various locations throughout Kabul, filled water cartons at his office, and drove home to a residential compound where he lived with his family and his brother's family. As his own children and his brother's children ran to greet him, a U.S. Air Force Reaper drone launched a missile at his car, re-incinerating him, and the 9 loved ones gathered around him. For those who have been paying attention, it is not surprising that Biden's drone strike killed a family, and it will not be surprising if additional bombing of Afghanistan kills more civilians. This is the very nature of the drone program, which became a norm of U.S. policy under the Obama administration. This is the story that the New York Times uncovered through extensive interviews with Ahmadi's neighbors, colleagues, and medical experts. The Washington Post did its own extensive reporting and reached the same conclusion of the events. The story that U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Mark Milley gave to the public to justify the strike is very different. Milley claimed that the attack was a righteous strike against ISIS-K members. U.S. military fed the lie to reporters that there was a second blast following the drone strike, proving that Ahmadi had explosives in his car, which he was planning on using to launch a second terrorist attack on Kabul airport. Those explosives were, in fact, the water cartons Ahmadi was bringing to his family. The New York Times and Washington Post both found that there was no second blast, just the one directed by the U.S. military that incinerated 7 kids. Responding to the Times reporting on Twitter, Matthew Hope, a disabled combat veteran, an anti-war activist, put it best. This very well sums up the last 20 years. Fear, barbarism, ineptitude, and lying. This drone strike follows the same logic that 20 years ago turned 9/11 from a day of tragedy and violence into 2 decades of tragedy and violence. What was never correct was the idea pushed by the politicians in the highest positions of power and media outlets with the largest platforms that in exchange for these 2,996 lives, hundreds of thousands more needed to be taken. It was incorrect, but it was possible because the U.S. lives taken on 9/11 were made out to be more valuable than the lives of Afghans or Iraqis. 20 years later, U.S. troops were finally leaving Afghanistan for good. An attack on Kabul airport killed 13 U.S. troops. 170 Afghans were also killed by the attack, as well as shooting by U.S. forces in the immediate aftermath. However, much like on 9/11, it's the smaller number of American lives lost that are significant to the corporate press and politicians. It is because the lives of these 13 American troops matter more to certain sections of the American public than Biden vowed revenge. In exchange for the lives of these 13 troops, 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children, were easy targets for retribution. Then, U.S. government lied about these victims, claiming they were terrorists. U.S. troops may no longer be occupying Afghanistan, but if the devaluing of Afghan lives, the violence of the U.S. war machine, and the lies from U.S. leaders continue, it could only be a matter of time before they are dragged back into war again. Biden has already made clear his commitment to keep bombing Afghanistan. For those who have been paying attention, it is not surprising that Biden's drone strike killed a family, and it will not be surprising if additional bombing of Afghanistan kills more civilians. This is the very nature of the drone program, which became a norm of U.S. policy under the Obama administration. From January 2012 to February 2013, the U.S. terrorized Afghanistan with Operation Haymaker, a military campaign of drone warfare in which 90% of victims were not the intended targets. No one from the Obama administration has faced any consequences for the terror of the drone program, nor have any members of the Trump administration faced consequences for waiving rules of engagement for airstrikes in Afghanistan, resulting in a spike in civilian casualties. Daniel Hale, however, was sentenced to 4 years in prison for having the courage to provide the public with information about the drone program and its disregard for civilians. If voices like his were not silenced behind bars, maybe there would be more public outrage, or at least public acknowledgement of the civilian toll of U.S. bombs and drones. The war on Afghanistan is not over until the drone program has been shut down. The Afghan people have been paid reparations with money taken directly out of the Pentagon's budget, and prison cells have swapped out whistleblowers for war criminals. Along with this full ending of the war, the United States will need a reckoning with the militaristic culture, which made war on Afghanistan at first a popular demand and later a background noise that most Americans could ignore. That militaristic culture is still packed into American entertainment and news commentary, simmering until the next reason for war allows it to boil into another frenzy of xenophobic vengeance.
Good morning.
heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.